Welcome to Radio Survivor. We're here for the love of radio and sound. My name is Paul Riesmandel.
Hello, everybody. Eric Klein here.
And we're really thrilled to welcome back this week for a very quick repeat appearance, Professor Andrew Bottomley from SUNY Oneonta. Welcome, Andrew.
Yeah, thank you, Paul. Thank you, Eric. Good to be here.
And one of the reasons why I wanted Andrew to come back with us is because we're going to dig back into the history of internet radio, and we're really excited to welcome our special guest, Carl Malamud, who is early trailblazer, the trailblazer for audio on the internet. Currently, he is the president and founder of Public Resource. But Carl, you did a lot of great work to first bring audio onto the internet, and we're really thrilled you could join us. Thank you for joining us today on Radio Survivor.
Thanks for having me, Paul, Eric. I really appreciate this.
So, you know, you're credited with creating what is largely considered the first internet radio talk show. It was called Geek of the Week, and it goes, you started that, was it in 1993, is that correct?
Yeah, we went on the air actually on April 1 of 1993. We almost didn't go on the air and wanted to say everybody, hey, you know, it was a joke, but we decided to go ahead anyway.
and I can say that I know, I can think back to 1993 myself, because that was the year I first saw the World Wide Web, but not until the fall. I never saw the internet prior to April 1 of 1993, I think. And so it's sort of an amazing thing to think that you were already doing audio. Can you take us back to this time? You know, how did this idea germinate? One, that you thought you could put audio on the internet in the first place, because it's hard for us to think now that we're in such a multimedia environment, but people principally looked at it as a text medium or a data medium and not really suitable for audio or video.
Yeah, I mean, my browser at that time was a text-only
right.
affair. Like, pictures, if they were on websites, were represented by, code words that told me that the name of that particular picture. Like, that was the internet.
So how did that idea germinate, that you would put audio online?
Well, I was I had written a number of professional reference books about computer networks, and was teaching seminars and you know, writing for the trade press. But I was also participating in the Internet Engineering Task Force, which gets together three times a year, hashes out the internet protocols. And in those days, you know, 1991, 1992, it was very active. They were putting together email protocols, and there were some people doing video streaming and audio streaming, and they were actually allowing remote participation in the IETF, the Internet Engineering Task Force meetings. And so they would hook it up so that they would have meeting rooms, and people would be in the meeting rooms, but someone else could be like in Australia, and they could be listening, and they could ask a question. And that was somewhat revolutionary. And because I was kind of a hands-on guy, I kind of helped, you know, on setup when it came to the computers for every IETF meeting, and got to know some of the people like Van Jacobsen and Steve Deering and others that had actually invented the protocols that were used to stream audio and video. And those, by the way, are the same protocols that we're using today, which is pretty amazing because they actually got it right. And as I was attending these meetings and watching people participate remotely, I also had this feeling that I wanted to get my hands much dirtier, because I'd been writing books and teaching seminars, but what I wasn't doing was actually, like, you know, doing stuff like on the net. And I wanted to do something, and I thought about it, and it was like, you know, what the hell? Why not just start a radio program? And, you know, the easy thing to do would be interview my peers in the IETF, and hence the term Geek of the Week. And so I went and asked people like Vint Cerf and, you know, Stephen Wolf, who was the National Science Foundation guy running the NSF net, the backbone of the net at the time. And I said, well, what do you think? Do a little radio program. And they were like, go for it.
Carl, did you have a background in radio?
I actually sort of did. I graduated from the Interlochen Arts Academy, and my senior year I was there, I had a minor in radio broadcasting. So I worked at the student radio station. But, you know, I was very much an amateur. And when I decided to, like, start audio on the net. It was hard because I really didn't know the technology of radio. And even like audio on a computer, you had to go buy a sound card and install it in your computer and then download the device driver and get it up and running.
It wasn't just built in back then, right? It wasn't a microphone. With every computer like we experience now.
No, you had to configure it to do that. It was actually fairly like hard, particularly on these fancy like Sun workstations and things like that. You really had to like download a device driver. And in our case, we were doing things like, so I bought an early DAT deck.
You're talking about is digital audio tape.
Digital audio tape was the latest great thing. It was the modern wave of the future. And so we decided to do that. And there was technology for recording audio like on Sun workstations, but it was only 8 kilohertz. It was low resolution. And in order to record the 48 kilohertz that a DAT deck does, which is, you know, professional
CD quality
resolution,
yeah.
You bet, someone had to write us a device driver that actually was able to handle
someone had to code a custom computer program for all intents and purposes to take this audio that you were recording on your digital audio tape.
Yeah, it was non-trivial. I mean, it wasn't that hard. I mean, it was mostly a hack. I mean, I'm credited with inventing radio, but I think invention is the wrong word. It was a hack. It was like the internet is ready to do this. And my thought was that, you know, audio was really big. It was like 30 megabytes for a half hour of audio. And in those days, that was a big deal. But my thought was you could do this, and you know, you probably couldn't do it real time, although we were doing real time, we were doing live streaming, but for your average user, and by average user, I mean a systems administrator in Australia or in a national research lab, for them, they had to download it. And so the idea was we would put these AU files, these 30 megabyte half hour interviews, up on an FTP server, and people would download them. And when the download was done, you know, might take 12 hours. You could listen to your radio program.
and you know, your audience at the time, I mean, certainly the audience that you're speaking to explicitly are computer geeks, right? People who are deeply into the technology of the internet in 1993. But the folks are generally speaking, I mean, they're not at home, right, on broadband connections. Were they largely in offices at universities or at government agencies? On, you know, the places that actually had these sort of direct internet connections, you know, do you have a, I mean, and where were you producing from? How did you connect to the internet?
So I was, I started in my home in Alexandria, Virginia, and I had a reasonable internet line, but, you know, we're talking dial up. But, you know, my users, so in those days, the internet wasn't that big, but, you know, all the major universities had reasonably good internet access. All the big government labs had it. And I thought my audience was, you know, the geek of the week crowd. But when I started this, we kind of got lucky in that the New York Times put us on their front page, you know, move over Ted Turner. And it turned out our audience wasn't just that. So what I did is I got a studio in the National Press Building. I rented one. I convinced WorldCom, which was doing the fiber in the DC area. It was
one of the big telecoms at the time. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I went to them and said, hey, I started a radio station. Look, front page New York Times. What do you think? And I understand you're laying fiber and you're up the street a few blocks from me. And they said, well, you know, we can run the trucks down a few more blocks. Let's get the permits. And they ran it up 10 stories into the National Press Building. And they wired my office at 10 megabits per second, which was like really fast for those days. Mm-hmm. And so I walked up two more floors to the National Press Building and I said, you know, to the National Press Club. And I said, hey, you know, I'd like to broadcast your luncheon addresses. And as part of that, I can give you free internet for the club. And I can even build you a website. And so we ran the fiber up two more stories, and they had three broadcast booths. One of them had National Public Radio in them. One of them was like for TV, and the third was empty. And I said, well, you know, while I'm here, do you mind if I have one of your broadcast booths? And so we threw another DAT deck up in that booth. We ran the audio on down to our studio. And so we very quickly started doing National Press Club luncheons. We went to Harper Audio And said, and, hey,
Carl, you said doing, and I just want to emphasize for the audience that by doing, you mean broadcasting these meetings live on the internet over audio for the first time ever.
For 5 months, we recorded everything, got it ready to go, and then put it on the FTP server.
Yeah.
And then by December, though, by December of 93, we were live streaming them.
Wow. So in this case, doing was the first time shifted internet radio
the
program.
The first podcast.
Yeah, the first podcast. Although the word podcast implies a few
for
things that we're not going to get into.
12 or 13 years, yes, but you know.
Yeah, Dave Weiner doesn't like it when I use the word podcasting, because podcasting technically is an MP3 file with an RSS feed.
Right.
And we weren't doing that, but you know, it's pretty much the same thing. So a radio program, whatever that you want to call it, really doesn't matter to me. And like I said, it's not an invention. It was a hack. So, but it worked, and it was a general audience. So with Harper Collins, for example, we got rights to do low resolution audio transmission on the internet of their cassette tapes. So they had T.S. Eliot reading The Wasteland. They had Robert Frost reading his own words. They had J.R. Tolkien reading his own words. And so I cut this deal, and they were like, what do we have to lose? Low res, we're not going to lose any money. And they sent me 100 cassette tapes. And so we bought a cassette tape, you know, deck, and recorded all that to disc, and I put a nice little intro on the beginning of each one, and put those on the net. We joined the public radio satellite system, so I put a satellite dish on the roof of the National Press Building, and I got syndication rights for, like, Tech Nation, for example. Morrigan was just online then, and was very interested in the net, and she said, sure, you have rights to rebroadcast my program. So we had a pretty varied amount of, like, syndication as well as our original programming. And that was very quick. It was within 6 months. We were doing a dozen different programs.
Wow. That's quite a spool up. I have to ask, how did you come up with money to fund this? It wasn't free, was it?
So it was fairly low budget. I didn't have a lot of staff. It was me and my friend Marty Lucas was the producer. I had a full-time sysadmin working for me. So I got some money from Tim O'Reilly at O'Reilly Media. I went to Sun Microsystems and said, hey, how would you like to, you know, sponsor a radio program?
And just to sort of set it up here, I want to lay some, you know, just I'm going to stop you just for a second, because Tim O'Reilly is a publisher of O'Reilly Books, which are has been one of the premier publishers, really, of technical books, especially for people who are programmers or do system administration.
Right. Animals on the cover.
With animals on the cover. So that's something which, you know, not everyone in the audience is probably aware of. And as well, you know, Sun Microsystems is a name that no longer people know because they're not really in business. But at the time, we're making these very powerful workstation computers that sort of help people bridge that gap from working on big mainframes in the 70s and 80s down to working on personal computers, right, in the 90s and 2000s.
And I had installed a lot of Sun workstations. So I started my career at the Federal Reserve Board. I was at Indiana University, then I went to the Federal Reserve Board and helped kind of, you know, change the way they did computing. I did a lot of consulting. So I knew the folks at Sun, and, you know, my friend Eric Schmidt was actually the guy that was running the division that did computer networking.
And why would people know who Eric Schmidt is now?
Well, he's at a little company called Google, although he seems to have successfully, like, you know, he got parole, and I don't think he's actively involved there. But
it was initial leader and founder, correct? Yeah.
Yeah. So Sun, the big thing I got out of Sun was they gave me all the hardware that I could swallow. So they and those were expensive workstations in those days. So they gave me computers. IBM was a sponsor. You know, Tim O'Reilly at O'Reilly Media was, and then I put all the money I had into it. I took all my savings and I dumped it into this.
Oh, wow.
It just seemed like an opportunity and was worth doing.
You know, you say it's an opportunity, it was worth doing, and you've got these folks, you know, like O'Reilly Media, Sun Microsystems willing to contribute to it. You know, it sounds very much like a startup. My question is, you thought it was worth doing to put in your savings. What did you see, a profit potential? what did you see, or did you see just simply it was too much of a good idea to let pass, and the Billy Sustain It would come.
Right. And again, to let listeners know who just might be joining us, this idea that's too good to let pass is the idea of putting audio on the internet that's time shifted in 1993 or so, 1994.
So when I started this, it wasn't a company; it was a project, right? Mm-hmm. It was something I was doing, and I was put money into it, but it was me, sole proprietorship and all that. So we made front page of the New York Times, above the fold. I actually knew the article was going to run. And so I went to the coffee shop that day and I got my New York Times and, you know, I flipped it to the bottom below the fold and said, well, no, the article isn't there. I guess we didn't make it today because it had been a couple weeks. And so I was reading the paper. And I finally said, okay, what the hell? We're not in here today. And so I flipped the paper back over to the above the fold and there was the article. So, and then I got home and there must've been 500 phone calls. It was nuts. And one of the calls was a guy named Nicholas Negroponte, who ran the MIT Media Lab. And he goes, Carl, this is amazing. This is totally amazing. Send me your business plan. And I was like, Nick, well, thank you so much. I don't know if we have a business plan. And so I thought about it and I called him back the next day and I said, you know, Nick, I thought about this. I decided to make this a nonprofit. And he was disgusted with me. He thought this was like a real opportunity that I was letting go. Eric Schmidt was the same way. He was quoted in the New York Times saying he just didn't understand why I did that. I made it a nonprofit for a couple of reasons. I was very impressed by C-SPAN and National Public Radio and that world. It seemed to me that we were early. And if we were going to be a business, we'd have to, you know, figure out how to monetize it in a business model. And it seemed to me that this medium was brand new and there was a lot of opportunity to move it in different directions. And as a nonprofit, you could do that more effectively. Hmm. As a nonprofit, it was much easier for me to go to National Public Radio and say, let me join, you know, your satellite system. It meant that when I went to the United States Congress and said, please give me congressional press credentials, I was able to get those. And it was actually the first and only new media credentials they gave. And then for the next 10 years, they didn't give any more. They were like, no, you're not really real media if you're on the internet. But I had mine, and that meant I had free access to the Capitol. We were able to put a tie line, which was a dedicated audio line, into the basement of the Capitol. And so by January 94, we were doing live streaming of the floor of the House and the floor of the Senate, including with a guy named Deb Roy, who's now a senior professor at the Media Lab. He was an intern at the time. He did voice recognition. So he was able to couple the congressional record to the audio. So we had a search engine and you could say, I want to hear all members of Congress from Minnesota speaking about the budget. But then it would pull up the audio and you could actually hear it.
But do we have that now? Why was this easy to do in 1994 and we don't have it in 2020?
Oh, I don't know. It's all doable now. We actually demoed it to several senators and you know, offered to give our code to them, but that didn't happen. So ran it for, you know, a year or two and you know, Deb ended up like being a you know, senior media lab professor. He was chief data scientist at Twitter. He's just, you know, a real rocket scientist when it comes to a whole bunch of things. But in those days it was audio recognition was the thing he was doing.
If we go back then to 1994, Carl Malamud, most people are not connected to the internet at home, right? Some people are. I was, because I was a graduate student at the University of Illinois at the time, and that was something that I got as part of being there, though, you know, certainly connected with better access on campus. But, you know, home access was just starting to come about it for the average person. There's no such thing as Wi-Fi, no such thing as mobile broadband. You know, cell phones are just starting to exist. But
most people
data.
Aren't on laptops. Most people are on desktops.
Yeah, I mean, and here you are streaming audio, you know, both doing live streams and then, of course, archiving audio for people to get at later times. I mean, how big was it by, say, January of 1994 when you've got, you know, House and Senate floor action going out? Do you have any sense for, like, how big the audience was or who was tuning in?
Yeah, Geek of the Week episodes were getting hundreds to thousands of people listening to them, which we thought was big. So the internet was small, but it wasn't that small. It's smaller than today. And, you know, we kind of thought it was hubris to say, oh, gee, everybody on the planet's going to be connected. And we're not even there yet, right? It's not everybody yet. But in those days, it was, you know, every college student pretty much in the major universities had access. And, you know, a lot of people in big corporations did. And so it was. You know, our audience was, you know, in the tens to, you know, maybe hundreds of thousands. We did some websites in 95, and I did the Internet World's Fair in 96. And in 96, we had 5 million unique visitors visit the Internet World's Fair site. And, you know, it was like 80 different countries were visiting. So it was significant, at least by our standards.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
If I could jump in, Carl, just to ask you a little bit about the kind of the mission that really was driving you here. Because, I mean, as you point out, I mean, you decided to do this as a nonprofit. And a lot of these projects you're involved with, like, you know, around that time, like the Congressional Memory Project. I mean, and of course, your career now with, you know, publicresearch.org. I mean, you're an advocate. I mean, that's, I think, the thing that really drives you more than some desire to you know, make a lot of money or whatever that, you know, we often think of when we think of, you know, technology and particularly internet technology. But at this time, I mean, the choice to put radio on the internet and your ability to convince all of these big firms like, you know, Sun to back you and O'Reilly to back you was really because, I mean, you were someone who was really quite vocal about wanting to sort of demonstrate what the internet could do, and also not just what the internet could do as a technology, but what it could do as a social and even a political tool, right?
Well, and it was more than just advocacy. It was doing it for real. And I think that's the reason people like Eric at Sun and others, because it wasn't just a demo. This wasn't a hi, you know, welcome to the Media Lab. Let me show you the future of, you know, collaborative filtering thing. And although some of that technology actually really, like, you know, went very, very far. They were an amazing incubator for, but I was trying to do projects that were real, that could force change, that could do so in a way that would be long lasting. And so putting the National Press Club online wasn't about, you know, getting rights to the press club and being their exclusive voice. It was teaching them to own and operate their own website, which they did. And in fact, I gave them press.org. I had press.org as one of my domain names, and I ended up just saying, here's your domain name. but the idea was that by doing it for real, you can bring millions of people into a new service, and you can use that leverage as a way to get the large institutions, the governments, the corporations, to change their ways. And so it's a way of doing long-lasting social change, and not in the sense of, hi, I'm at a think tank, here's a white paper, but in the sense of, this is for real, it's time for you to act.
And when you say change their ways, Carl, I'm assuming you mean like opening up so that information is more accessible to more people instead of like certain elites that had always had access to like, I don't know, like government meetings, for instance.
Yeah, that's part. Openness is certainly part of it, but a lot of it, particularly when I work with government, I try to be very clear with them that this is partly about openness, but this isn't sunlight is the best disinfection. We're doing this to hold your feet to the fire. It's more of, this is a better way of doing things that will make you more effective. And one of the ways you do that is to be open. But a lot of this is about using the computers and the networks more effectively to carry out your mission. So the Securities and Exchange Commission, it was partly about, you know, making sure anyone could read the annual report of IBM and, you know, make sure they weren't getting away with anything. But it was mostly about making our financial markets more efficient and transparent and more effective. And that's how I sold it to the chairman of the SEC. Right. It wasn't the sunlight argument. It was that, you know, you're going to be able to do your job more effectively this way. And you know what? I'm getting a million users a day using these SEC reports, and it doesn't cost that much money, so you can do this. This is not a big adventuresome leap on your part.
Like, if I could grab an example of our time, you can let me know if it's too far-fetched. Like the idea that like health data during the pandemic if it was more widely available so that all sorts of people could download the data, more scientists all across the world might be able to pick apart that information and find more solutions that would help us today.
Well, so if journal articles, of which the majority are behind a paywall, were more broadly available, people could do text and data mining and come up with significant scientific results. So it's not just the government data, right, about reports that has to be more transparent. It's the data as a whole. In fact, that's one of the areas we're heavily involved in right now, is the idea that text and data mining on scientific journal articles is something anybody ought to be able to do. And you don't need permission from the journal publishers to do that. That's actually a somewhat controversial point of view.
Yeah, it's amazing to use the word data mining, and it gets my hackles up because it's a bad word. The trillionaires use data mining to control us, as opposed to the notion that data mining is just a technique that could help all of us understand the world. If data mining was easier to access for all people, yeah.
To bring this back around to radio, though, maybe.
Thank you, Andrew.
To Carl, but I mean, there were quite a few projects that were involved in around the same time as the Internet Multicasting Service and Internet Talk Radio that were text projects too. But with this, with Geek of the Week, with Internet Talk Radio as a channel, you chose radio. And I wonder if you could say a little bit more about, what the appeal was of radio or audio. If there's anything that you think of as radio as a medium that really I think matches with some of these principles that you're describing here.
Well, so I was attracted to radio, a longtime National Public Radio listener. The reason I did audio is because video was just too damn hard to do. It was too big. It was hard to edit. I mean, even editing audio was not easy. I ended up buying a DigiDesign board and a bunch of Mackie boards and having to learn all those. And, thank God Marty Lucas knew a lot of this stuff already. But it was a real learning experience. Video was like significantly harder. And about 2004, I bought my first high def cameras and started working with those. And that was really hard. And it's still hard. I'm still learning video. We're deep in that right now as part of my work with Public Resource. But in 93, it was forget about it. We were doing video on the net. We were doing live streaming. But it was live streaming 4 frames per second, right? Which is like, I mean, it's very much stop motion video. And the resolution was like, 320 by 240. So it was, on your current computer screen, it's that, that's kind of what an icon is. Little bitty, images, very stop frame. It just wasn't doable. But the insight on audio was that you could do 8 kilohertz audio, which again is not very good by today's standards, but it was good enough. So 8 kilohertz is like AM radio. Right. And that was kind of the insight, was you could do AM radio on the internet today. So let's get started. But video was just, it would have been too hard.
At that time then as well, and it's something we've talked with Andrew about a couple of times, 1993, 1994, when you're putting up Geek of the Week, you're doing these live stream of House and Senate proceedings. You've got the National Press Club luncheons being broadcast on the internet. There's not a lot of conventional radio, and it sounds like not a lot of conventional radio, broadcast radio, aside from what you were helping with, Carl, right? Because you were at least putting audio for some forward-looking NPR shows, and the thing what people often forget about NPR is, of course, it's not a monolith. Stations are independent. There are programs that are independently produced that are just distributed by NPR over their satellite system, which you had access to. But NPR itself, National Public Radio, which does produce the big national programs like
All Things Considered,
Morning Edition, was not yet on the internet. And my understanding is you were talking with them back then in 1994-ish.
Yeah, so I mean, I had been on Science Friday, and I was on Tech Nation a few times, and I think All Things Considered might have covered us when we hit the New York Times. And my lawyer was the former general counsel of National Public Radio, so he had some contacts in that world. But no, they weren't heavily involved. They were right down the street. I was in Washington, D.C., and they had their brand new headquarters on Massachusetts Avenue. So I went in a few times and visited, but no, I didn't know, you know, they didn't have a new media group, and they didn't have a, you know, what's the future of NPR. They might have had a group doing that, but they certainly weren't talking to me.
And on Radio Survivor, like a few episodes ago, we had Andrew Bottomley on, who's today is acting as a co-host of the program, asking Carl Malamud questions today. And we sort of got, we sort of started speculating about whether or not National Public Radio in the 90s, was hostile to being on the internet or indifferent to being on the internet? Why did it take them, you know, in 1994, it might have been early, but in the year 2000, they were still behind the curve, right? They weren't leading the way on the internet, if my memory serves me, if the history is right. So do you have any information about that? Do you know if anyone was excited for NPR to be on the internet, or if anyone was hostile to the notion?
Oh, yeah, there were a lot of individuals that were very forward-looking. There's some really smart hosts and some really good techs that work at NPR. And, you know, they knew what was going on. But management was going through their periodic, you know, new president just joined, we have a new strategic direction, we're, and they weren't indifferent. They were more like ignorant. They just weren't following it. So I mean, their techs knew what was going on, but the managers were in the radio world, and it was hard to get their attention. I tried, but I didn't have any luck.
And so, looking again at 1994 in that sort of pivotal early internet period, did you make contact with other traditional, you know, terrestrial broadcasters, or were you really more focused on figuring out what other types of audio content that really wasn't being broadcast in any sort of way onto the internet?
So NBC got really like excited with my Internet World's Fair. This is like 95 when I was doing that. And they said, oh, yeah. You know, we want to be a sponsor. And I speaking to some fancy executive vice president, and we signed an agreement, and then they stiffed me. They never paid the money that was sponsorship. And it was $100,000. I mean, it was, you know, real money, but they just ended up not paying. You know,
and what is the Internet World Fair? I don't think I'd heard of this before. So you're saying in 1995 you threw the Internet World Fair. What was that?
96. So 95 we organized it. So the idea was, you know, let's do. I mean, I was like enamored of World's Fairs, and you know, from the late 1800s and the 1900s. And I was having lunch one day with Vint Cerf, the father of the internet. And I said, yeah, then we should do a World's Fair. And he was like, go for it. This would be great. And he was at MCI. And so I talked to a bunch of friends around the world. And we organized a World's Fair that ran for all of 1996. We had 70 countries participating. And the question is, what does a World's Fair look like on the internet? And, you know, we wanted to make it not just the net. And so we had a very fancy, you know, website. But we also had a whole bunch of events in the real world. So Todd Machover, for example, MIT Media Lab, very famous opera composer. That's how I got to know the Media Lab better, is because Todd called me up after he read about the World's Fair in the New York Times and said, I want to be part of this. And he had a new opera that was like crowdsourcing music from the internet, like it would be part of the opera. And he had Lincoln Center was going to be his debut. And so I worked with Todd and we got Lincoln Center online and, you know, did live streaming of the Brain Opera. We had people in Japan doing all sorts of street fairs. A guy named Joey Ito, who was, again, at the Media Lab as their director, ran a very fancy street fair there. Taiwan was totally into it. So Taiwan and Tibet really liked the World's Fair because early on I decided I was not the guy that was going to decide who could be a country, because we had country pavilions. And so Taiwan came in and said, we want to do a country pavilion. I was like, go for it. We had actual formal protests from China. They're saying, you cannot possibly allow Taiwan to be a country. I said, look, you want to do a pavilion, but I'm not going to, you know, like. So Taiwan was so like happy with this. They put internet viewing pavilions in like every train station in Taiwan, including the central train station, huge banners all over the place. And they had a dozen, you know, people wearing fancy, you know, World's Fair uniforms. And as people were going to catch their train, they would be, hello, would you like to see the internet? So it was really kind of fun. I traveled, I did six round the world trips in 95 to organize it and six round the world trips in 96 to, you know, I was meeting government ministers. We got a letter, Yeah.
Carl Malmut, can you tell us about any special audio experiments at that Internet World's Fair in 1996? Was radio, was time-shifted audio a part of the fair?
Oh, it sort of was, in the sense of like the Brain Opera, like, you know, brought in audio from, like, you know, people could actually compose audio on Java apps that ran on your browser, and that became part of the opera in Lincoln Center. But no, radio was not like a key component. This was not a radio thing. It was a World's Fair thing. But, you know, these metaphors kind of morph. I mean, you know, internet radio wasn't really radio. It was something new. And our World's Fair was something new.
And we are speaking with Carl Malamud. He is currently president and founder of Public Resource. The reason we're talking with him here on Radio Survivor is that he was responsible for what is often credited as the first internet radio talk show called Geek of the Week, and some trailblazing efforts in putting audio both live and on demand on the internet back in the early 90s, starting around 1993. This is Radio Survivor. I'm Paul Riesmandel. I'm here with Eric Klein, and we're also joined by our special co-host, Professor Andrew Bottomley.
Hi.
And you know, we're really digging into this prehistory, because, you know, it's so easy for this stuff to get lost, and as well that, you know, because the internet has taken over our lives or become part of our lives in ways that maybe some predicted in 1993. But at the time, it was almost science fiction, right?
Well, I'm certainly excited to talk to Carl today about the notion that all of the hacks that he was doing with audio on the internet was more about the joy of building something new and and demonstrating the technology, rather than trying to patent stuff and build a new company that would take over the world. It's the internet of my youth that now I feel... now I regret the nostalgia because of how so many gigantic internet companies seem to be, not acting in the public's best interest. And here was a time when building something online was for everybody. And that's a very Radio Survivor feeling that radio is here for all of us to be using to communicate with one another. And that, you know, back in the 90s, this was still... So it's still possible.
Yeah, I want to touch on the podcasting thing, because, you know, Geek of the Week, you did it, you live stream, but also you put files up on the internet that people could download, right? So they could go listen on demand, a fairly radical idea at the time. And during, you know, into the 20-teens, you know, there was a company called Personal Audio that had a patent that they said covered podcasting, right?
This is one of the biggest stories of the decade, right?
In podcasting,
the podcast industry.
Right. So, you know, they had a patent which they filed for, I believe, in 1996. And originally their technology was, they were sending cassettes of of magazines being read, sort of podcasts in a way, to people, you know, in a serialized fashion, which they then amended to say they would do it on the internet. And it filed this patent before the name podcast had taken root, before the sort of fundamental technology behind what we know as podcasting took root, the RSS feed that allows you to automatically download an MP3 file enclosure. So they then went about in the late 2000s into the 20-teens, threatening podcasters, most famously going after Adam Carolla. But I believe they also won judgments against like CBS Interactive, Discovery Networks, saying that basically anyone making podcasts and having to, you know, and making money at them was going to owe them a royalty, because they had, in fact, invented the medium. And the Electronic Frontier Foundation fought this in court, but ultimately took it to the, you know, ultimately won a judgment at the patent office itself, right? Which is the body which with which you file patents and which you can also challenge a patent. And one of the pieces of evidence that they used to get this patent invalidated was your show, Geek of the Week. And the EFF argued that the very fact that you had basically serialized audio, a weekly radio show.
Prior art, right?
That you had recorded and put on the internet as early as 1993, and they could demonstrate it. There was evidence to show that it existed and that there was even press coverage of it, was in effect prior art 3 years earlier, saying that this idea of serialized audio on the internet existed. What did you think? Did the EFF talk to you when this was going down? What did you think when you found out that that's something you did in 1993 was being used to kind of help the podcast industry in some extent not get immediately stifled?
I know the EFF folks very well. They're my law firm right now.
Okay.
And the folks did talk to me. So it turns out that my evidence, the stuff I had done, was actually thrown out by the tribunal, and EFF relied on other evidence that this had happened before. But there was some technicality. I'm always very, when people say I invented, you know, the first internet radio station, I'm always very quick to say, no, I didn't invent it. It was a hack. It was applying technology in a way that made sense, that rolled
in some ways
out.
Would you say it was like technology that was just waiting to be put together and somebody just had to provide some of the glue?
Yeah. No, that's all it was. It was a very stupid patent on podcasting. It's like the email patent. It's like so many of these business process and software patents. So one of the things I did at Internet Multicasting is I put the U.S. patent database on the internet for the first time. I actually bought all their data and put it online over the objections of the commissioner. And it was my theory that the commissioner at the time, Bruce Lehman, was issuing bad patents knowingly, right? Mm-hmm. Because he made revenue based on patent filing fees and on selling patent DVDs. And I think he knew that a lot of the patents he was issuing were garbage. They were not original. They were not inventions. And it was the beginning of a huge number of bad patents that have been since issued and are still being issued. If you're a .com, one of the things you have to deal with is a patent thicket that the big companies like Apple and Samsung and IBM and the others have, and they can knock you out because they have so many patents and patent litigation is so expensive that there's just no way you can defend against these spurious claims that what you are doing somehow violates their intellectual property rights. It's one of the more broken parts of our current economy. It's not helping promote inventors. It is not promoting creativity and innovation. It's an arbitrage on stupid ideas. It's a bargaining chip that you use to bargain with other big corporations, but it's not serving the purpose of the increase and diffusion of knowledge, which is what patents are supposed to do.
Absolutely. And of course, you know, it's great that this evidence could be submitted, whether it was from you or from other sources, to so that Radio Survivor here, which is a podcast in addition to being a radio show, isn't subject to having to pay royalties for the simple fact that we're right, making it and posting it online. You know, because podcasting is, I would argue, you know, while it's certainly developed into a very robust business, has been tremendous tremendously instrumental in reviving the popularity of voice and talk programming, audio right, programming.
I mean, you say it's been a robust business, Paul, but I believe you even would know the data that the majority of what is being put out by humans on Earth
is not monetized. Yes,
is for free because they want to share their voice with listeners.
And that seems very compatible with what you were trying to do at the time, Carl. And it seems like in some ways that you've dedicated your career to. And so, you know, how long did you continue to work on these internet broadcasts of various sorts in audio through the 90s?
I ran internet multicasting through mid 96 and we just literally ran out of money. Again, NBC stiffed us. It was really hard raising money for an operational nonprofit, particularly by like 96, 97, you know, companies like Netscape were beginning to happen. The
you mean all my
revolution.
Celebration, all my celebration of the world of non-commercial giving things away for free didn't turn out.
Well, I just couldn't keep it going. And so my colleagues overseas kept the World's Fair going, which was nice, particularly in Japan and Rob Blockschild in the Netherlands. Nick Negroponte gave me a place to land for a little while at the Media Lab to catch my breath. And then I went over to Japan as a visiting professor at Keio University for a little while. And again, I wrote my book about the World's Fair, and MIT Press went ahead and published that. I got the Dalai Lama to write the forward, which was very cool. Even just as cool, Laurie Anderson wrote the afterword. So I felt like I was talking to real rock stars. She was always one of my heroes anyway. So
And so Internet Multicast is the name of your organization. And so what you were doing, so part of your what you were producing was the World's Fair, the Internet World's Fair. You were producing these various multicasts or broadcasts on the internet. Was there anything else you were involved in?
Yeah, we put the Securities and Exchange Commission and the U.S. Patent Office on the internet and then shoved the databases back down their throat and made them do it, which was very successful. My friend Marshall Rose and I came up with a system called the Phone Company, which allowed you to send free faxes to anyone using email. It was the first use of the internet to do bypass, the idea that faxes and phone calls would go over the internet instead of over traditional telephone lines. So it was somewhat controversial because in theory, the Federal Communications Commission regulated that stuff. But we ended up with service in dozens and dozens of countries. It was fun. A couple of the components of that have survived in modern voice over the internet protocol. So a little bit of what we did there. And it was mostly the work that Marshall did that made that happen.
So when you think back to that time, you've had quite a bit of time in between. What do you see? How do you view the legacy of those early days? Certainly by 1996, your organization was not the only one either doing live or even archived audio on the internet. Things had started to become a little bit more common. Some radio stations had joined the fray, as did. Pure play internet only broadcasters. But
yeah, remember Paul Jones put radio stations up in like 93, 94. So that had been happening. Rob Glaser came along with Real Audio. And in fact, my current lawyer is David Halperin, a very well-known Washington guy. He was a speechwriter for Bill Clinton. But little known fact, he was a co-founder of Real Audio with Rob Glaser. Because when Rob first started Real Audio, he thought it would be a progressive radio station on the internet. Progressive, was the name of his company.
Yeah, and you mean like politically progressive, right?
Yeah. And that didn't fly. There was no money for that. And so he ended up doing the streaming thing.
Interesting. Hey, Carl, I'd like, as we round out today's radio program and maybe head off into the podcast, I'd love to return to Andrew's question from half the show ago, where you had this choice in the 1994 time where you chose audio, where you chose to make radio with the internet. And your answer to Andrew was like, well, audio is easier than video. Video is even harder. But I wonder if you could answer the question again about what did you gain by recording radio shows and giving them out on the internet as opposed to, a newsletter, writing stuff down? Why was it important to talk to people and record the interview?
Oh, there were a lot of like newsletters out there, and that wouldn't have been like very inventive. In fact, that was a big business in those days. A lot of people selling newsletters and stuff. Nobody was doing audio on the net. And I always look for things that if other people are doing it, then they should go ahead and do it. I look for opportunities where people aren't doing it, and I think it's maybe ready for prime time, and audio seemed to be ready for prime time.
I wonder do you know of any examples of like, by recording interviews, did you learn something that you would not have, did you create something that would have otherwise been been left out, right?
Yeah, if we had just done the live streaming. In fact, I remember when Associated Press came in and we were doing the National Press Club luncheons live for the first time. It was Al Gore, actually. And so the reporter's sitting there looking at my son's workstation, and he goes, well, can you tell how many people are listening? I said, yeah, six. And he was really disappointed. He's like, what? I said, yeah, but they're on four continents. Look, this guy's in Australia. This guy's in Germany. This guy's in Japan. And he was a little more impressed at that point. If we had not done the time shifting, the record, I mean, it was obvious to me that live was interesting and I wanted to do it. We even had a 24/7 rock and roll station on the internet because we actually got a BMI provisional license. And because they didn't
BMI
have
is a
license.
Rights organization, right? That pays songwriters royalties. Yeah.
Yeah. And because they didn't know what the internet was, I was able to basically, you know, demand that they give me a public radio, you know, streaming. And so we were doing live streaming of rock and roll, but it was very clear that was going to be a very small audience. Whereas the time shifting thing, the recorded to disc, let people listen to it when they want, had a substantial effect. And like I said, there were hundreds of people listening to Geek of the Week episodes. Even today, I'm getting hundreds of people per week listening to Geek of the Week.
Right, because they're on the Internet Archive, right? This stuff is all still available for folks. Thank you to the amazing people, of course, at the Internet Archive.
So a little known story, I'm sorry, Andrew, I didn't mean to cut you off. Brewster Kahle, who runs the Internet Archive, came up to me in 1996. And he said, Carl, I want to archive the web. And I was like, okay, well, that's pretty ambitious, even in those days. And he goes, well, do you have any hardware? And I happen to have a tape jukebox that we use for the Securities and Exchange Commission data. And I didn't need it anymore because the SEC was online. And so I gave Brewster his first hardware for what ended up becoming the Internet Archives. So I've known Brewster for ages and ages. I love the work he does. He is an amazing story of someone dedicating his winnings from .com, where he did very well, to a life of public service. And he has built something just amazing, absolutely amazing, at a whole different scale than I operate at. I mean, this is like major league.
Andrew, did you have a question, something you want to come in?
Yeah,
Professor Andrew Bottomley.
Carl, it's interesting that you were saying right there that, you know, you're kind of most proud of the asynchronous radio, the time-shifted stuff that you were doing from like 93 to and 94. I think, if I'm not mistaken, it was like January 95 when you started doing the live streaming with the RTFM and the music programming that you're talking about. And funny enough, right, that's really for the rest of the 90s, most folks who were working in the internet radio or streaming audio space were doing stuff that was live streamed. I mean, there was some programming that was like archived online for later listening, but most of it until really the early 2000s, when people like Dave Weiner come along with, you know, audio blogging that became podcasting, you know, it was almost another decade before time shifted audio really became a thing again, at least in terms of the primary sort of focus that it's largely become with podcasting now. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if you have anything more to say about that, but I just thought it was interesting that you made that distinction there, because it was like live streaming seemed to be the thing when we talk about 90s audio on the internet. I think most people, until they hear something like this, weren't even really aware that there was the time shifted or asynchronous audio as early as it was, of course, because that's where you started.
So the live streaming thing, and I had talks with many, many people about that. It's like, look, live stream your program, but also put it on disc. And people weren't doing that. And Dave Weiner's brilliant insight was to, you know, bring MP3 and RSS and the concept of audio blogging in and show people that that made sense. He got people like Adam Curry that were actually like, you know, doing professional programming. And it was kind of a right place, right time, right idea kind of thing. And so Dave kind of pushed that over the hump. But you're right. In the 90s, people were like, you know, time shifting. I mean, there were the beginning of digital video recorders were beginning to happen by the late 90s. So people were time shifting their television. But that wasn't live streaming. That was coming in over cable, being recorded to disc, and then you could watch your program later on your TV.
You know, Carl, it's interesting. I did a radio program on community radio that I ended up distributing like we do Radio Survivor now, but through the 90s into the 2000s. And it was circa about 2002, so a little ahead of the podcasting RSS specification, that I started posting my shows online, because again, a little community radio show in you know, Urbana, Illinois, it has so much of a footprint, especially because it was kind of it was about independent media and technology. It was something of maybe broad interest, and it seemed to me, gosh, you know, only so many people can ever hear this Friday at 5:30 p.m. You know, even people who live in the area. So I, you know, why aren't more people using the internet for time shifting? You know, and eventually it turned into a podcast, and eventually, you know, and it became syndicated because the first, you know, community radio manager in Moscow, Idaho, got a hold of me and said, hey, you know, if you could be a little more timely in getting these posted each week, not just when you feel like it, we would run it on our radio station here in Idaho. And I put it up, and so I had the similar thing, although I'm already, you know, at that point, 10 years behind you. But I, at the time, I will have to say I was aware of Geek of the Week. I became aware of it fairly early there in the 90s, working, you know, in university computer labs. And so with pretty good access to internet and Sun workstations, as it turned out, in many cases. So but it's just a little anecdote, you know, because I think it was. It's like this potentiality that was waiting to be realized, and you kind of showed that it was there, but it even took even longer before it took fire.
So a lot of people, when they create a new service, they create the service they want to see. Mm-hmm. But they're not creating a service that's going to reach people. And the ones that are successful are the ones that deliver something to people that they actually want and can use. And that's a lot of the Silicon Valley folks don't get that. They're doing what they think you need rather than something you might actually want. And that was kind of, again, with the delayed audio, it just seemed obvious to me that if I wanted to, not only that, we had time changes, right? So, I mean, I was like in Washington, D.C., and a lot of my listeners were in Japan. Right. I, you know, what am I going to do? Put this on at 3 a.m? Mm-hmm. It just didn't make any sense. So, but a lot of people didn't get that, and particularly a lot of the early .com startups in the kind of mid to late 90s, you know, they created things that they wanted, that some engineer thought you might want, but not something you really wanted, and especially not something you really needed. And that's something companies like Google got, right? It's like, you need to be able to search the internet better. And all of a sudden, like, everybody's using your service. It's a lesson I learned. If you can build something that gets millions of eyeballs, you have a lot more credibility when you're meeting some government minister or member of Congress and saying, you know, you ought to be doing things differently, or the law ought to be different, or your government, you know, IT infrastructure sucks and it could be better. If they look at you and you're writing white papers for some think tank, they're like, okay, thank you so much for the visit. If you say, listen, I have 5 million people using my service every day, that's really different. Politicians respect eyeballs. They respect the fact that there's a lot of people out there that care about this.
Carl Malamud, it's been a great pleasure speaking with you and hearing about both the work that you did back in the early 90s, as well as the work you're doing today and continue to do to help, you know, enhance public access to what should be public information. So folks can certainly learn more at public.resource.org. Also, Professor Andrew Bottomley, thanks for joining us again for this wide-ranging chat about this early history of internet radio. It's always fantastic to have you on.
Yeah, well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Eric and Paul, for inviting me. And Andrew, thank you so much for that book. You did a beautiful job documenting history. That's well worth a PhD, and I really enjoyed the book. So thanks for writing that.
Oh, thank you, Carl. That's a real honor to hear that coming from you.
My thanks again to our guest, Carl Malamud. My thanks to Paul Rees-Mendel, my co-host, for producing today's episode, as well as our new co-host, Andrew Bottomley, who joined us today to interview Carl because Andrew was a guest on our podcast, episode number 253, just 2 weeks ago, talking about his book, Sound Streams, Dissecting the History of Internet Radio. And based on that interview, Carl reached out to us on Twitter, and we reached out to him to be a guest, and that's how this episode was made. You can listen to a much longer version of this interview, 40 extra minutes of content, online at radiosurvivor.com or on the podcast, Radio Survivor, wherever you get your podcasts. We love to hear from our listeners. You can email us. Our email address is podcast@radiosurvivor.com. And Radio Survivor is a listener and reader-supported enterprise. To find out more, visit radiosurvivor.com. patreon.com/support. On behalf of Paul Riesmandel, myself, Eric Klein, Jennifer Waits, as well as Matthew Lazar, the whole Radio Survivor team, we thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next week.